This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 20th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a report about how some local Marshall Island migrants may be eligible to enroll in the Arkansas Healthcare Marketplace for private insurance.
Plus, we go backstage at the Walton Arts Center, check in with meteorologist Dan Scoff for an explanation about the extreme changes we've seen in weather lately, and more.
But first, in an effort to better monitor the hours truck drivers are behind the wheel, devices will soon be required in trucks that will replace paper logs required today. Drivers are limited to only working 14 consecutive hours, and Lance Turner, a reporter with Arkansas Business, says the electronic onboard recorders will ensure they don't work more than that.
The Arkansas Trucking Association is behind this 100%. A lot of the work to get this going is going to begin next month. They'll have 2 years then after that to make sure all of these trucks are outfitted. We're talking about a $2 billion project to get this done, affecting about 3 million U.S. truck drivers across the country. And these devices, you know, cost is a concern for some of these trucking companies. These high-end electronic devices can cost, you know, is upwards of $2,000. Smaller-end devices can cost from $300 to $400 per truck.
But with a federal mandate set to take effect at the beginning of 2016, there is little doubt that the trucking companies will install the devices.
Arkansas Red Cross officials are on standby to help assess storm damage from weekend storms in the Midwest that may have caused close to $1 billion in damage. Bridget Williams with the Red Cross says the Red Cross began responding to the area soon after the storms hit.
Our neighbors in Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, and Tennessee did suffer damage, and unfortunately we've had loss of life. But almost immediately, as soon as the storm moved through the area, we had Red Cross crews out from those various states checking on people. We've opened more than 25 shelters across five states.
Williams says mobile units may be enlisted to provide food, cleanup kits, and other supplies to residents who are trying to rebuild their lives after recent tornadoes.
We are kind of in a hole pattern, if you will. More than 21 mobile units are currently on the scene from numerous states, including those that were hit, as well as Minnesota and Kansas and Nebraska. So at this time, we're just holding because, as you can imagine, there's still a lot of debris cleaning up and what have you to increase the ability to move around in those areas. So at this point, if we get the call, we have crews ready to go and help.
Williams says Arkansas crews remain on alert to aid in recovery efforts after the destruction of more than 1,000 homes and businesses. Initial estimates show the storms may have caused nearly $1 billion in damage.
The currently unoccupied acreage of the former Tyson Mexican original site in Fayetteville has moved one step closer to being home to new retail, green space, or other developments. Last night, the Fayetteville City Council unanimously approved a resolution in support of a request for proposal process to sell and develop the undeveloped 5.8 acres. The resolution called for reclassifying the parcel to city neighborhood zoning and to take bids for the land. The council also approved an amendment to the ordinance proposed by Alderwoman Sarah Marsh, which would require a minimum percentage of land sold to be retained by developers as usable green space.
So, you know, if they're developing it in a dense pattern, then we'll probably need a little bit more. Whereas if it's a few single-family residences, we could get away with less. So there are guidelines that determine how much is that recommend an amount of green space or community garden space per residential unit, and I think that we need to consult those.
Neighborhood gardens, parks, and green space were among the top three priorities of ward residents who participated in a recent public input session regarding how the city should use the land in question. The minimum required amount of green space will be suggested by city staff when it drafts the request for proposals for the land sale. Another amendment to the resolution requests that potential developers adhere to the city's low-impact design standards.
Gerber Products will be moving forward with an expansion at its Fort Smith plant after the city's board of directors yesterday authorized the issuance of taxable industrial development bonds for the company. According to the City Wire, the bonds will be issued in the amount of $150 million and be repaid in full by Gerber with no liability to the city. The expansion will result in 90 additional jobs through increased production at the plant.
A Springdale copper assembly producer will expand its facility. According to the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, American Tubing Incorporated, which produces copper components for the air conditioning and refrigeration industries, announced yesterday it will add 20,000 square feet for an aluminum copper component production line. The expansion, set to be ready for production sometime in 2014, will give the company 80,000 square feet of production space at the Springdale facility and add 50 new employees with an overall payroll increase of $1.35 million. The company has been in operation since 1976 and is a subsidiary of National Tubing Holding of Birmingham, Alabama.
The Razorback women's basketball team earned its fourth straight victory of the season last night with a 66-51 win at home over Middle Tennessee State. Arkansas is now 4-0 and will remain home to play another non-conference game against Missouri this Friday evening. Forecast this evening calls for cloudy skies with a 70% chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas, a 60% chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley, with overnight lows around 49 degrees. Tomorrow, an 80% chance for showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas, and a 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the River Valley, with highs around 60. Tomorrow evening, an 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms, with overnight lows in the lower 40s.
This is Ozarks at Large. Rex Nelson is no stranger to politics. He's the former political editor of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. He was Governor Mike Huckabee's communications director for nearly a decade. And in addition to other duties, he now wears the hat of president of the Political Animals Club of Central Arkansas. But with Asa Hutchinson rolling out his income tax cut plan this past week and Mike Ross touting a manufacturer's tax break, what are the politics at work here? Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently sat down with Rex Nelson to find out.
You've worked in a governor's office before. You've worked with a governor who has sought tax relief before. How doable is significant tax relief? When you start looking at the state budget and the different components of what those taxes do to provide just some of the mandatory services that you kind of have to, schools, jails, Medicaid, how much play is there really in the budget?
Well, the Hutchinson plan that came out this past week, which is estimated at about $100 million a year, from a financial standpoint, I think it's very doable. Mm-hmm. From a political standpoint, I'm not sure how doable, because here's what I mean by that. I think that $100 million probably would easiest come out of general improvement funds, which is the state surplus that goes out at the end. That is legislative crack, I've always called it. They got on it. They can't get off of it. They like handing out those checks, whether it's the local county fair, whatever, the improvement district, whatever it's going for. It's doable, but the 135 legislators would have a lot less money to hand out at the end of the session if we did it.
Let's take a look at the Asa Hutchinson tax plan here. I think we've got a graphic built on this. It's basically a 1% reduction for those making $20,000 to $75,000 a year. I can't remember where the exact cutoff is, but you go from 7 to 6%, 6 to 5%. Could impact close to 500,000 Arkansans by Asa Hutchinson's estimate. That price tag, as you mentioned, somewhere around $100 million. Heard a little bit higher figure, but that's something to be debated. So in the Huckabee administration, you guys made some efforts to reduce taxes. Where were you most successful and why were you most successful?
Well, we were early on struggling with some ideas of how do we do this. We first came up when the governor first came into office in 1996 with a rebate plan that just didn't fly at all. In fact,
it crashed and burned, if I recall correctly.
If you'll remember, in his first State of the State address, Governor Huckabee used the old joke about the company that had come up with this great brand of new dog food and so forth and was wondering why they couldn't sell it. And the punchline was, the dogs just won't eat the stuff. And the legislators just wouldn't accept that plan. So we worked on the brackets a little bit, cutting the number of low-income taxpayers off the state income tax rolls. That was much easier to do than a rebate plan would have been, as it turned out.
Curtis Coleman, Deborah Hobbs, two Republican primary challengers to Asa Hutchinson, basically say these tax cuts aren't large enough. We need to do more. We need to cut capital gains. We need to cut corporate income taxes. Do those seem realistic to you? If $100 million in very incremental individual income tax cuts are part of a plan that is dubious at best, could you even do more?
I think it would be difficult. I mean, there's always fat in government. There are efficiencies we can find. But overall, we run a pretty lean operation in Arkansas when you compare it to a lot of other states around the country. The fact is, politically, Curtis Coleman and Debbie Hobbs are so far behind right now that they have to stake out a position that's different than Hutchinson's, whatever it is, and they're both staking out a position that is even more to the right of Asa Hutchinson. They're going to try to come at him from his right. Of course, they're going to divide up those votes, but again, those plans would be awfully hard. As I said, even the $100 million, I think, if you start talking about it coming from general improvement, would be difficult for a Governor Hutchinson, if he were to win, to get through the legislature, even if his own party were to continue to control the legislature.
Mike Ross, the Democratic candidate for governor, the only one in the race right now, says that he too is for tax cuts. Just they have to be targeted, responsible. The only thing he's come out with so far is a tax cut for manufacturers, basically for parts and upgrades. That price tag's about $40 million. He has suggested he will propose some more targeted tax cuts in the future. In essence, he's pitching a business first strategy in rolling out that tax cut first. Is that smart politics?
I think it's pretty smart politics, and it's right along the line of the Mike Ross that we saw in the U.S. Congress. Of course, Roby, we've still got a while to the filing period, and there may be one get in. But as of right now, there are no wild-eyed liberals in this gubernatorial race. I mean, Mike Ross is conservative, even though he's a Democrat. He was the chief blue dog up in Washington, D.C., often bucked the leadership there. Mm-hmm. So you would expect him to come with more of a conservative fiscal approach to government. That's what he's going to do. On a lot of these issues, I think you're probably going to see Hutchinson and Ross more close on issues than a lot of people think right now that they will be.
That was Rex Nelson, president of the Political Animals Club of Central Arkansas, speaking to Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity: coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com.
This week in This American Life.
Yes, I'm looking for a one-bedroom apartment for me and my wife. Yes,
Have you possibly looked for a place to live lately? It's unpleasant, right?
I don't have nothing.
You don't have anything.
Okay, actually, that's a lie. The guy has places. The secret to get past him and others revealed this week.
This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, certain Marshall Island migrants living in the United States are eligible to enroll onto the Arkansas Healthcare Marketplace for private insurance. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attended a health fair this weekend in Springdale designed to encourage islanders to enroll, and she brings us the story.
Nian Chakar sits at a table at the Jones Center for Families trying to fill out insurance paperwork while holding her squirming baby girl. Chakar says she doesn't see a doctor except for when she was pregnant. She went to a low-income clinic in Springdale, which serves migrant Marshallese.
Do you hope to enroll by December 15th, and then you will be eligible for medical insurance starting January 1st?
Yes, she says. Nian shows Brandy Cooper an in-person assister guide, her passport, Form I-94, which she received when she entered the U.S., and her Social Security card. Brandy Cooper is based at Friendship Community Care of Washington County.
Yes, well, today is my first time actually being in the population and actually speaking with the Marshallese people individually. So it's been a very nice experience, very interesting, and very insightful as well.
Insightful? Because Marshallese hold a privileged status in the United States. Under a compact of free association, they can travel to the U.S. to live and work without a visa. The U.S. maintains strategic military operations on the Republic of the Marshall Islands, which include a nuclear test bomb program back in the 1950s. As such, islanders are considered lawfully present, making them eligible to enroll in the federal insurance marketplace. As many as 6,000 Marshallese live in Northwest Arkansas, the largest population on the mainland. And the Arkansas Minority Health Commission is encouraging as many islanders as possible to enroll by staging this two-day event, providing free food, health screenings, and translators. Executive Director Idonia Trotter.
My understanding is that Marshall Islanders are eligible to apply under the marketplace for the subsidies that it provides. The income level, not only for the Marshall Islanders, but for everyone, the income levels will make a difference as to how people will qualify for this. What we do know is that in the state of Arkansas, they're not eligible for Medicaid.
Nor are Marshallese eligible for Arkansas's private option, which is expanding Medicaid coverage to tens of thousands more low-income Arkansans. California, Washington State, and Hawaii convey state Medicaid dollars to Marshallese migrants. Arkansas does not. A half dozen IPA guides from various nonprofit and state agencies visit with islanders, including manager Joanna Seitz from Community Clinic in Springdale. She says none have come by the clinic to enroll since the marketplace opened October 1st. She's not had much luck at this event.
So no one has approached us to enroll here. Yes, they have been asking questions about our services at the community clinic, and that's as far as it's extended. We've been giving them information about the Arkansas Health Insurance Marketplace.
Part of the problem is that Marshallese prefer to not discuss personal matters with strangers, but Sandy Harris-Joel's table is packed with Marshallese. She's Marshallese Outreach Coordinator for Credit Counseling of Arkansas. She says new concepts must be embraced by the entire community first to be accepted.
Marshallese are like getting information from each other. It's like a chain. You go, then I follow you. If you have feel it, I will feel it too. You know about it, I will know about it. So it's like people teach each other, and we copy each other from what we learn that is good for us.
She says Marshallese are unsure about the Affordable Care Act because in the first place, they were promised certain entitlements when they moved to the United States.
We believe that we came here to take the advantage of our compact with the United States. There was a document signed, promised that we can come here with free medical. And when we come to Arkansas, there was no free medical.
When Sandy Joel lived on the West Coast, she enrolled in Medi-Cal, California's Medicaid program. And Arkansas Marshallese could be eligible, according to the State Department of Human Services, if islanders secure legal permanent residency and live here for 5 years. But those qualifications are really strict. And Native Marshallese children have no access to state Our Kids First. So with no insurance and little money, where do these islanders go for medical care?
They have no choice but to walk in the emergency room.
Or they go to local community clinics, which charge a sliding scale fee. Sandy Joel says she knows many working islanders who refuse to enroll in their company's insurance because the copay is too high. So she's hoping they will opt into the federal marketplace. Islanders with an income between 100% and 400% of federal poverty will be eligible for generous tax credits.
Most people that come to my office, I deal with them, I help them with budget. So I know the income.
Marshallese activist Melissa Leilon is a board member of the Arkansas Minority Health Commission and helped to organize this event.
Well, first of all, I'm a big fan of this because it will allow a lot of Marshall Islanders that have been left out of the system for a long time. So this is going to be a chance and an opportunity for us to have that coverage that we've been needing for a long time. And not only that, but it also offers discounted rate as well.
Leyland says compared to the Latino population, major barriers exist here.
The other IPA tables, most of them don't have any documentation, any kind of documents translated into Marshallese. We only have two licensed, one licensed IPA and one licensed Navigator at this point. And these are Marshallese. I'm talking about Marshallese.
Local and state public health agencies have been assisting Ozark Islanders for almost two decades because they're acutely aware that Marshallese have the highest incidence of tuberculosis, a lung disease, among Pacific Island nations. And Marshallese are at risk for leukemia, thyroid, and breast cancer due to direct or indirect exposure to radiation from U.S. nuclear weapons testing on the Marshalls. Consumption of processed Western foods places them at risk for heart disease and diabetes. LaGoria Payton, a physician assistant with the Arkansas Minority Health Commission and coordinator of this event, is shocked by what she's seeing here.
What I have found, which is really surprising to me because I'm not familiar with this community's health profile, we have a number of people whose blood sugar results were well over 400. They are not under a physician's care. They do not have medication. It's just unbelievable to me.
Blood glucose above 400 is considered a medical emergency. Stephanie Vang, an insurance navigator with Legal Aid of Arkansas based in Fayetteville, has a Marshallese IPA guide on staff. They've managed to pre-enroll several islanders today.
For most of them, we've just given them the paperwork. The initial response has been a little bit of hesitancy. So most of them just want to take the application home and review it before they actually enroll.
And at home, Marshallese families can decide if the new affordable health care is, well, affordable. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, November 20th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, had I known, I'd have taken more art classes.
Had you known what?
That Northwest Arkansas and the River Valley were going to grow up to be these great visual art centers.
There's still time.
I'd have taken more art classes, but I'm learning.
Good.
And currently we're learning about Winslow Homer.
Okay.
They have an exhibit called Winslow Homer and the American Pictorial Press on show right now at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum.
So who's Winslow Homer?
Winslow Homer was a lithographer when he was a teenager that did a lot of work for like Harper's Weekly. Spent almost 20 years as an illustrator before he decided to paint full time. And eventually became a really celebrated artist, particularly for his maritime scenes. But the early stuff is a lot of the everyday life that was on the covers of magazines at that time, and they have a whole bunch of it at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum, which you probably haven't seen yet if you're from Northwest Arkansas. So you can get down there and see this exhibit.
I saw it while it was under construction. Mm-hmm. That was a while ago.
The exhibit comes from Syracuse University, and it also includes some pieces by his contemporaries, Thomas Nast, who would end up being a political cartoonist for Harper's. When Winslow Homer was illustrating things for Harper's Weekly, their circulation a week was 200,000 people.
Oh, wow.
At that time.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So it's a pretty cool exhibit. And it's on through January 5th. It is free. And you can find out more at fsram.org.
Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Thank you so much, Kat Robinson, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Now, on the surface, it may not seem like something you'd want your child to do. Many parents might just think it's not possible for their child to catch a bird.
But I know better. See, I was a bird-catching child. And I know a thing or two about catching birds.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
In our monthly Spaces series, we take you to some unique spaces within our listening area. Today, we go behind the scenes at the Walton Arts Center. But before we see what happens backstage, let's start with what you see on stage. During a Friday morning last month, dozens of workers in black clothing gathered on stage to prepare for the touring production of Beauty and the Beast. Crew members moved set pieces across the stage while others helped mount items to be hung high above the stage. This is an example of the work that must happen before the audience arrives on opening night. The first part of the on-location preparation begins with the load-in. When a touring production comes to town, assistant production manager Valerie Jones explains, the first thing that must be done is emptying trucks from the loading dock, which is located on the west side of the venue. Touring Broadway shows typically travel with several truckloads of material. Beauty and the Beast, for example, used 5 semi-trucks. Jones says the largest show they've had was Jersey Boys, which was billed as 9 trucks, but it really used 10.5 trucks. Jones says it tends to take longer to unload the trucks than to pack them back up, but it's a very organized process. She says they're packed like jigsaw puzzles, with items being unloaded and reloaded in a specific order every time. To make your way back toward the stage in Baumwalker Hall, you must head east from the dock door along a long hallway.
This is our hallway where everybody clocks in, checks in, signs in, our information boards. This is our administrative offices for the production department, and which also doubles as the laundry room for the company. So there is a washer and dryer in there, and they do a lot of laundry.
The next stop on the tour is the tech office.
This office is for 5 people that share these two and a half desks. So this is our technical department, where our head carpenter, our head electrician, and our head of audio reside, as well as their 2 house assistants. We have 2 full-time house crew that work in audio, video, as well as carpentry and electrics.
As we continue down the hall, Jones points out the catering kitchen, which also doubles as a crew lounge during Broadway shows. Next up is the green room, which Jones says is typically used for artist hospitality, but again, that changes when Broadway productions bring larger crews. During these weeks, the green room, which recently received a fresh coat of paint and new posters, becomes a production office for touring companies who move in their own computers and printers to do their work. It's at this point you begin to realize the staff at the Walton Arts Center uses every bit of the venue's space.
As the shows get bigger and we do more of them, I mean, 5 truck show is pretty typical for what's on the road nowadays. You know, and the 9 truck show and the 13 truck shows, those are becoming more typical. They're not making shows smaller. They're continuing to make them bigger. They will travel lighter, you know, so that they can be green. But, you know, the shows are, there's a lot of really big venues out there that can accommodate these shows.
Jones says the Walton Arts Center is classified as small by the International Association of Venue Managers, but they would like to be mid-sized and eventually large. That might happen in the near future as the venue moves forward with its expansion plans. Earlier this month, Fayetteville residents voted to issue $6.9 million in bonds to help fund renovation plans for the nearly 22-year-old venue. Continuing down the hall, we pass by dressing rooms, Jones says, have also been a tight squeeze for some companies. The principal dressing rooms, for example, are designed to comfortably accommodate 1 person. However, they have been occupied by as many as 6 young actors in the case of Billy Elliot. The doors of the dressing rooms have photos of actors along with their names, which Jones says helps wardrobe supervisors know more quickly which actors they are helping get dressed. In addition to realizing how carefully staff must use the area backstage, another surprise is learning how many local residents are a part of the crew.
We have a really good local crew for being a non-union house. We have 130 overhires that are just, you know, people of Fayetteville that love to work in the arts, and they all have other jobs, so they just do this for a little extra money and just to be part of something that's bigger than they are. And it's really interesting that, you know, it helps. Some students do it the whole time they're here going to school, and, you know, some parents do it so that they, you know, can, you know, have other ways to engage their family in the arts, because there are a lot of benefits that come along with working as a member of local crew as well, if you're here long enough.
About 20 local crew members worked on Beauty and the Beast. As you near the end of the long hallway, you'll find a door to your left that leads to the stage where there are several crew members working. While most of them are dressed in black, each of them has a different color of tape on their shirt. Assistant production manager Valerie Jones explains a color coding system makes it easier for the touring company to know who people are. For example, electricians are typically wearing red tape. Located about 70 feet above the stage is what's called the grid. Jones points to a spiral staircase comprised of more than 80 stairs that serve as the gateway to the grid. Chain motors hang from up there, and they are attached to what's called the fly rail.
Come in, upstage!
And so what the fly rail operators are doing is, because everybody's separated into different teams on stage here. So you've got electricians working, you've got props people working, you've got carpenters working, and as you can see, there's a lot of pipes flying in and out. So everybody that is on stage has been trained to know where they are on the stage and to listen to these calls coming from the rail. So Josh is making sure that everybody on deck knows that something's about to move so that they can be aware of their place, where they are, and know that it's going to come in safely without hitting them in the head.
Weight loaders, let's take line set 35 to 540 pounds.
So what they're doing is they're going to put weight on the arbor, because this is a counterweight system. So each one of these bricks is probably about 50 pounds. They come in different denominations. So what he's doing is he is tying that off so that it cannot move. If there's more weight on the pipe that's associated with this particular rope than there is on the arbor, on the counterweight, then it's going to want to move, go up or down. So he's steadying it so it can't move while they change the weight on it.
There is enough room on the fly rail to hang up to 51 items from the grid. Items can include lights, movie screens, and hard set pieces. Jones says they can hang in excess of 2,500 pounds on a single pipe. Sometimes shows travel with a small core group of musicians, and that is supplemented with local musicians. Other times, the larger Broadway shows travel with their own orchestras. When the orchestra pit is in use, the first few rows of seats are removed from Baumwalker Hall. The orchestra pit is often used for storage, so when musicians need to occupy that space, those stored items are moved to Star Theater.
Star Theater, during a Broadway show, is used for wardrobe, wigs and makeup, and then any back storage. Sometimes, depending on the show, some shows that are extremely dance heavy, I'll travel with a physical therapist, and so we'll have to pipe and drape off a physical therapy booth. Sometimes if we have, they have musicians that travel with them and the actors are using all of the dressing rooms, we'll have to make a dressing room here for the musicians.
Star Theater's control booth can also be used as a remote studio for musicians in instances where the musical group is so large it won't fit in the orchestra pit, or if a particular section makes it too loud for the other musicians to hear. The musicians in Star Theater can tell what's happening in the orchestra pit in Baumwalker Hall thanks to a live video of the conductor. TV screens are often located in the wings backstage as well, so actors can watch the conductor for their cues. Upon completion of a backstage tour at the Walton Arts Center, it's impressive and perhaps surprising to realize all of the things that happen out of view of the audience to make everything on stage run smoothly.
One of the things that we tell our new hires when they go through training is there are a lot of distractions happening backstage. The two biggest distractions when you're backstage that will cause you to miss a cue are A, you're watching the show, or B, you're watching the people that are coming and going on and off stage, because, you know, we do have small spaces and the idea is that everybody can change in their dressing room. Well, if you've got 30-second change, that doesn't happen. So at any, you know, time, there could be people in various states of dress running around backstage, and everybody's okay with that. You know, I mean, you have to be professional and move on. For me, I think that's probably, you know, one of the things that people probably don't think about. You know, I think they have this idea of, you know, the star of the show, and they're sitting in front of their mirror and they're doing their hair and they're like, 5 minutes. And it's like, you know, that happens at the beginning of the show. But once the show starts, it's off to the races. And then it's over before you know it.
More information about the venue is available at waltonartcenter.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Congratulations are in order for a couple of folks at the University of Arkansas. Kristen Joskowski, University of Arkansas Assistant Professor of Community Health Promotion and Affiliate Faculty Member of Gender Studies, has been named a research fellow at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction at Indiana University. Researchers with the Institute investigate and inform the public about critical issues in sexuality and sexual health. The Institute was founded in 1947 by biologist Alfred Kinsey, who was considered to be a pioneering sex researcher, and it remains the oldest sexuality research institute in the United States. Director of the Kinsey Institute says the title of research fellow with the Kinsey Institute expresses appreciation for her contributions to its research and teaching mission and recognizes her commitment and active involvement in the Institute's research program. The title is valid for 3 years with a possibility of extension.
We would also like to congratulate Lance Harder, head coach for the U of A women's cross country team, for being named the USTF CCCA South Central Region Coach of the Year. The announcement comes after Harder helped coach the Razorbacks to their third NCAA South Central Regional title in a row. The Razorbacks scored 33 points in the meet to earn the largest margin of victory in the NCAA South Central Regional en route to the program's 18th regional title. Harder also led the Razorbacks to their 14th SEC championship earlier this season. This marks the seventh time that Harder has been named the South Central Region Coach of the Year. The Razorbacks will return to the course for the final meet of the season Saturday in Terre Haute, Indiana. The women's 6K is scheduled to start at 12:15.
And congratulations to Donald Ung, a second-year law student at the University of Arkansas School of Law. He was awarded the National Student of the Year Award at the National Asian Pacific American Bar Association Conference in Kansas City, November 15th. This national merit-based scholarship recognizes a law student who demonstrates substantial leadership in the community. Ung is the first School of Law student to win the National Student of the Year Award. Ung's background in film from UCLA, coupled with his legal training at the law school, makes his contributions to various bar associations incredibly unique.
The design of a University of Arkansas Fort Smith graphic design student will soon be seen on chests across the nation. A t-shirt with a design by Daniel Kling of Muldrow, Oklahoma, is now on sale at more than 100 Gap retail stores across the U.S. The retailer ordered 15,000 units of a t-shirt design Kling made in her UAFS digital illustration class. It was part of a project where students submitted designs into a weekly contest on Threadless, an online clothing retailer that sells designs created by users. Her design, a blueprint diagramming a spider web titled Web Construction, did not win the contest, but Gap, which had partnered with Threadless to sell the website's clothing merchandise at select Gap locations across North America, sent her an email out of the blue expressing interest in purchasing it. The shirts are for sale at locations in 3 countries across North America, the U.S., Puerto Rico, and Canada, and in approximately 30 states in the U.S. The nearest Gap and Threadless retail stores carrying the design are in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Dallas, Texas.
Tomorrow, the Fort Smith Regional Museum will host an opening reception from 5 to 7 p.m. The event will feature a preview of new work by Arkansas-based contemporary artist James Folkert. Snacks and beverages will be served. The event is free and open to the public. You can reserve your spot by emailing rsvp@fsram.org. And on Saturday, Still on the Hill will return to the Bentonville Public Library. The library's annual concert will feature a performance by the musical duo at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Since 2001, Kelly Mulholland and Donna Sterna have toured steadily and produced 6 CDs. Both are accomplished songwriters and play a plethora of acoustic instruments, including acoustic guitar, banjo, fiddle, mandolin, and harmonica. The group's repertoire is primarily their own original roots-based compositions, interspersed with new arrangements of traditional songs. The concert, which will be in the Bentonville Public Library's Walmart Community Room, is free and open to the public. More information is available at www.bentonvillelibrary.org.
You can also go to stillonthehill.com for more information about the band. Rogers Little Theater will hold auditions for Les Miserables on Monday and Tuesday, December 9th and 10th at scheduled times at the Historic Victory Theater, which is located at 116 South 2nd Street in Rogers. Performances will be in February and March. Auditions will be based upon singing music from the show and an audition packet containing a complete listing of the roles to be cast, scheduled audition times for the roles, the music, the readings, rehearsal schedule, and other information may be obtained by downloading it from rogerslittletheater.org or by contacting the RLT box office at 479-631-8988.
Have you heard the saying, if you don't like the weather in Northwest Arkansas, stick around 10 minutes and it'll change? Last week was a prime example of that. Fayetteville experienced the lowest temperatures of the season on Wednesday. Come Sunday, it was sunny with highs in the 70s. To find out why we see these dramatic changes, I consulted with Chief Meteorologist with KNWA, Dan Scoff. Our conversation took place on Monday of this week.
We experienced, you know, a transition period. November has always been known as a transition month for Northwest Arkansas. The weather can rapidly change, and we knew this system coming in, you know, on the TV broadcast that was showing way up in Alaska, this system that's diving southeast, and it was a little bit it was a little bit questionable exactly the track that this system would take, but we knew it was going to be a big system. And in response to a big weather system, you get a strong south wind. And when you get a strong south wind and you pump in that moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, temperatures literally cannot drop below what we call the dew point temperature. So when that number climbs on the morning lows, then you know you're getting moisture that's added to the atmosphere, especially in the low levels. And that's going to lead to temperatures basically warming up throughout the morning. And that's exactly why we experienced such a rapid change in our weather pattern. We had a high-pressure system that came in from the northwest. That parked itself over us on the 13th when we saw the coldest morning that we've seen so far this season when Fayetteville hit 17 degrees. And then we went throughout the rest of the, you know, week with that high pressure shifting off to the east, and when you're on the west side of a high, you get a south wind, and then you got a big low pressure system that was organizing to our west. And over the next couple of days, you know, the moisture was just poised to come up from the Gulf of Mexico, and once it did, temperatures rapidly warmed. So that's exactly why we experienced such a drastic change in temperature. And now, you know, we fell back down. This morning we hit just about freezing, and that's all because of that cold front clearing out the moisture again.
I know. On Sunday, I was at Lake Fayetteville in literally shorts and a tank top.
Yeah.
And then I'm curled up in a sweatpants and a sweatshirt.
Yeah, and we did get a freeze, by the way. We hit 32. We hit freezing. And so, you know, where those surface winds, a warming wind is a south wind and a cold wind is a north wind, usually, generally. And that's what we had. We had a big shift in our pattern, and the reason that the weather was so crazy is we call this a progressive pattern. You know, some patterns stick around and they last a while, but you'll notice that we've had these fast-moving weather systems that just kind of ripped through the area and didn't last very long. For instance, over the weekend, we had some rain on Saturday, and it didn't last very long, but all of these systems came through, and there was nothing to stop them from, you know, from continuing to progress eastward. Just like, for instance, the tornado outbreak system on Sunday, November 17th, when that system came through, the next day it's already off the coast of the United States. That's what you call a pretty progressive weather pattern, to say the least.
Well, so I know that in Illinois this past weekend that they did experience some of those tornadoes. But the weather here was also kind of prime for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. People don't realize that, you know, I had a saying, we were only a couple of degrees away from disaster. And what I mean by that is the computer model forecasts, you know, we're very gung-ho about not breaking out precipitation. What we mean by that is meteorologists, that means they didn't form any storms. The problem is, as you and I know, that, you know, computer models aren't always correct. And because of them not being always correct and the conditions that we had over our area Saturday night into Sunday, especially it would be during the overnight hours, if storms developed, they would have been moving at 50 to 60 miles an hour. They would have produced strong to violent tornadoes, the atmospheric conditions that we had. But there was a big question. I'm not saying this is going to happen for sure, and probably it won't. But I want to give everyone a heads up in case it does, because our conditions were even more volatile of what they saw in Illinois. The only difference is they had the storms and we didn't.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, and, for them.
And fortunately for us, yeah. You know, there was, and people sometimes call it the Fayetteville fizzle or something like that. It just, we had, you know, that extra cloud cover, a little bit of rain that kept our temperature down a little more than it could have been. And if it was only a few degrees warmer.
Well, so Thanksgiving is next week.
Yes.
When can we expect the cold weather to be here to stay?
You know, we know as Northwest Arkansans, you know, and being in Arkansas, that you can't expect the cold weather to stay around forever, especially
right.
in this area, mm-hmm. because you do get these wild temperature swings. You know, as far as cooling down for good, it really doesn't happen in this area of the country. But I can tell you that I'm laughing because I'm looking at some of the long-range computer models that are, you know, about 8 to 9 days out, which is essentially right around Thanksgiving mm-hmm. time. And this is, you know, this is a ways out, and meteorologists are very
timid,
skeptical and timid to say this stuff. But, you know, there's a system that comes in on Thanksgiving, like a couple of days before Thanksgiving, that looks like it could bring snow. If that will happen or not remains to be seen. But I can tell you that it does appear that our pattern is about to undergo a change.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is colder weather. And not just colder for a little while. There will be warm-ups within that cold period, but I'm looking at some of the highs here, and they're pretty dramatic. Like, for instance, a high next over the weekend, you know, we got some holiday activities, you know, Lights of the Ozarks, getting people in the Christmas spirit and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And on Saturday night, it doesn't look very warm for Lights of the Ozarks. Bundle up
right.
if they're headed to that, because it does look, we're talking temps, high temperatures, struggling to get above freezing.
On Saturday?
Yeah. It makes my job interesting and fun, and job security, I guess right. you could say, well, in this area.
But what you're telling me is that Northwest Arkansas, it's not necessarily unique with this crazy weather that we have.
No, it's not. And yeah. it's happened before. You know, in 2005, we had some really cold weather, and then we had a massive tornado outbreak that happened on November 27th of 2005. And there's been some tornado outbreaks in November 2001.
Well, you mentioned Christmas, and you mentioned that it may snow on Thanksgiving.
Yes.
You're just kind of gut feeling. I won't hold you to it, I promise. But will we have snow on Christmas?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, and the reason I say that is one out of every 9 years on average, that's the statistics, mm-hmm. but one out of every 9 years is a white Christmas. We had a massive storm that came in, just missed Northwest Arkansas. You know, I know a lot of people were somewhat disappointed that it didn't snow. It's so rare to see a white Christmas. I do think we will see more snow this year than we saw last year, which isn't saying much. We had a lot of snows. They just weren't a lot of snow.
Very productive, yeah.
Yeah. We had a lot of snowfalls. You know, it snowed like maybe 15, 20 times, but there was never anything more than an inch. We had the one snow that came through right after Christmas, December 28th, I want to say, and it put down about an inch to 2 inches. That was probably our heaviest snow. And then, of course, the May snowstorm as
right.
well.
Right. I was going to mention that, yeah.
I say snowstorm, but, I mean, even an inch in May is pretty dramatic.
Exactly, yes. If it's snowing in May, you can call it a storm, I think.
Yeah, May 3rd and 4th, which is, you know, that just shows you the weather, it's not going to do what you say, you know, so far out in advance. It keeps you on your toes. It has a sense of humor. What you think might happen one year could be totally different the next. I do think that we will see more snow this year. I think that, you know, and someone asked me, when do they think the first snowfall will be? And I said it's going to be an early snowfall or late November. And oddly enough, the computer model forecasts are showing that.
So potentially next week.
Potentially next week, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Weather Dan. I'm allowed to call you Weather Dan, aren't I?
You sure are, yeah. No problem. We go way back, right?
Yeah, way back.
It just, the weather never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah. All right.
It's pretty awesome.
It
so,
is.
Well, good deal.
Okay.
Well, stay warm. It is going to get cold. There's definitely a 100% chance of that this weekend, and we'll see if that snow materializes.
All right. I'll get used to carrying my coat around with me.
Yeah, sounds good.
Dan Scoff is Chief Meteorologist with KNWA. This is Ozarks at Large.
Time to meet PT's new young artist in residence.
I started playing saxophone when I was in third grade. I thought it was cool.
Then in high school, he heard a classical saxophonist.
I didn't know classical saxophone existed. I was blown away, and all of a sudden I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Meet Jonathan Winteringham, our new young artist in residence, on Wednesday's Performance Today from 8 p.m.
Stay tuned to KUAF. Performance Today begins next after Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Rudy.
Rudy.
Yes. I drove to Fort Smith yesterday for a story we'll hear on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, and Rudy is the long 540 between Fayetteville and Fort Smith.
So. I like it. What's your story about?
Adoption. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, and so it's about foster kids that are in need of finding permanent homes. So.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to that. I'll have a story on as well. I spent some time yesterday with a local crafter mm-hmm. who will be participating in the little craft show, which continues to grow.
I'm excited about it this year. It's December 7th, I believe, mm-hmm. a little bit later than I believe it has been in the past. And it's always fun. It's always fun to go and see the interesting things the people create.
And it'll be at the Fayetteville Town Center. Mm-hmm. But that story about that crafter is part of our Locally Made series, where once a month we talk to folks making things locally. Mm-hmm. So that's all tomorrow on Ozarks at Large. The Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission has also scheduled something for tomorrow, a public meeting for tomorrow. And it's to gather information from local citizens who have an interest in an urbanized area north-south corridor fixed guideway transit system. The meeting will be an informal drop-in session from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Fayetteville City Administration Building.
The Fayetteville High School Choir invites ye noble lords and ladies to the 9th Annual Madrigal Feast, a royal Renaissance banquet. It's December 12th through the 14th at St. Paul's Episcopal Parish Hall. Seating begins at 6:45 with dinner served at 7. More information, 479-445-1168. And they say to please reserve your tickets by December 5th. And speaking of Madrigal, we'll have the Bentonville Madrigal Choir on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large.
We will. They were in here earlier this week, Monday, I believe. They came in, and Kyle Kellums, our co-host, our colleague, got to talk to a couple of them and have them sing a couple of songs. And so another thing to look forward to.
It was much different than what we normally hear, the music that we normally hear.
I haven't heard it yet, so I'm excited to hear it as well. And that'll be on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and have a happy Wednesday.